I was reading Diane de Prima's Revolutionary Letters, and in number 75 she writes, "The only war that matters is the war against the imagination. All other wars are subsumed in it." Considering the unprecedented global repression of artistic and academic freedoms, as well as the linguistic phenomenon of anti-Semitism being replaced by anti-Zionism and used to racialize and marginalize Arabs, punishing any solidarity with Arabs in service of a white supremacist imagination of a humanity without Arabs in it, how do you see the role of imagination and language resisting these forms of control?
Well, this is a pretty full-on question to begin with, with 100 ideas per second. I have to say that the first thing that I think of is that I cannot relate quickly. Also, at one level I do, obviously, but at one level I cannot relate in the midst of genocide about the idea that the only war that matters is the war against the imagination. The war that matters is the war that kills people. But it is quite interesting how the two are related, and we need to think. I feel saying we need to think full stop, because what is happening really is a war against thinking, not even against the imagination. To put it in a very pedestrian way, we have reached a point where we cannot call a spade a spade. And if you call a spade, you're committing some kind of sin. And what is happening in the shadow of the genocide in Gaza is that you're forbidden to say the obvious. So in that context, there is a clear relation between war and the war on stopping people from thinking about war. And there is no doubt that there is a concerted effort to stop us from thinking hard, from thinking in sophisticated manners, from thinking, well, not even sophisticated manners, but thinking in a humane, everyday manner. And so this attack on thinking in this way is an attack on the imagination, for sure. Whether it is artistic imagination or academic imagination. It is a serious problem because the attack is a warrior attack. And that's something I'm thinking through at the moment, because Zionists really are warriors. They don't use concepts to think, they use concepts to hurt. And so when people throw at you words, accusations that are aiming to hurt you, as an intellectual, your instinct is to hurt back. And you enter a very difficult situation, because as an intellectual, your job is to think hard. It's not to produce pedestrian concepts that hurt people. And so in a way, if you feel like replying by hurting back, you feel that they've already won, because they have reduced you to something you're not. So yeah, the war on imagination is a difficult and important topic. And the question is how do we preserve our imagination is kind of like very pressing at the moment.
And how do we hold on to a shared collective humanity? I was intrigued with a concept you had about settler colonies and how they contain the undemocratic parts, and how the problem only exists when the undemocratic parts starts to seep through, and how much a lecture you had like a decade ago almost now, you were talking about the criminality of Gaza, that the essence of Gaza as it is and as it was is criminality, and now how much that ignoring globally as a society, as a Western society, the criminality of Gaza, how much that criminality has now seeped into all other institutions as well.
Yes, it is true. We are living in a period partly because of social media, but also partly because the changing nature of imperialist power. We are entering an era where if you in the geography of colonial wars, and I'm not talking about settler colonials, I'm talking just about colonial wars as the first. It was easy to have a war in India and suppress Indian workers and suppress indigenous Indian people and enjoy a cup of Darjeeling tea in London and not think that there is a relation between the violence that's happening in India and the absolutely peaceful time you're having in a cafe in London enjoying your tea. There's a geographic separation, massive. Already in settler colonial settings, because the geography is not as distinct. Like you cannot, in a settler colonial, if you're a settler colonial in Algeria or in Australia, the settlers cannot do the killing like the English were doing the killing in India. The killing is near and close. And so the techniques of keeping people protected from the violence, because there's always two borders. There's the border where you're protecting yourself from the enemy, and the border where you're protecting yourself from the violence, because they're not the same borders. One is a border where the border against the enemy is a space of war. But there's also the people who want to protect themselves, not just from the enemy, but from war in its entirety. I don't want to feel there's anything disturbing my groovy, whatever I'm doing, that is peaceful and lovely. And so these techniques can be emotional, like not being at all emotionally attached to the killing, indifference, strategies of indifference, strategies of willful blindness. And there are some geographic aspects as well, but they are much more intermingled in the settler colony. I think we are increasingly facing a situation where this capacity to distinguish between the two spaces and protect ourselves and think, here we are, we're having a lovely time here in Sydney or Melbourne, violence is happening elsewhere, is being destroyed partly by social media. But I think it's also been destroyed by the fact that colonial power and imperial power itself has become less able to contain these boundaries. You know, I always love a section by the philosopher Nietzsche, where he's talking about what he says, sense of power. And in it, he is saying basically that people can have the same power, but a different sense of that power. So for instance, if you're strong, but you feel that your power is declining, it's not the same as you're strong and you feel your power is going on to be increasing. So if you have a power and you feel your power is increasing, you feel confident, you feel maybe you are able to be magnanimous towards your enemy. While even if you have exactly the same power and you're very powerful, but you feel your power is declining, you become cruel and petty and desperate. And I think we are seeing this latter form of imperialist and colonial power today. It's a power that is the exhibition of domination that is cruel and crude and in your face.
Historically, there's been similar moments, but there's been a greater resistance towards that. how much, like, I just recently finished an apprenticeship as well as just starting university this year, and I'm struck always about how much of a bloated managerial class exists in almost any institution now, and how much that reduces the effectiveness of any institution to carry out its stated purpose, and how much this then leads to the inability to front a resistance towards these large political problems and institutional problems.
Yes, well, that's you're touching on a huge issue here, but let me say that let us begin by a very simple thing, which is, while, yes, the question of how people within an institution can deal with political things is very important, but very important is if people can do their job well. As an academic, I think most people who read me know that I'm very political, but at the same time, I'm not someone who likes to reduce myself to a political moment. I take pride in my academic professionalism, and I like to be known as a professional academic before even being known as someone who is politically on the ball or capable of dealing with situation. And the two are related to a certain extent, but what is important, and in what you raised today, is that the increased managerialism is endangering my capacity to be professional. And one's professionalism is to be snatched from the institution, as opposed to the institution being the space where it can flourish. And that is a very serious problem.
Yeah, I'm confronted with talking to some friends that go to Uni Melbourne, and after the adoption of this, the new definitions, now there is groups of teachers and students that feel the need to meet outside of campus to discuss certain things or to have sort of creative endeavours because they fear the repercussions that these sorts of spaces now embody.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, even if there is no repercussion, even if universities adopted because they formally think everybody has adopted, which I know the case of a number of institutions who have adopted the thinking, they're just adopting some anti-Semitism thing and thinking, obviously, we want to be anti-Semitic, and therefore without, which is awful in a university to think that university people can actually sign a document without thinking through the consequences of their signing. But there is the case that there's a number of academic boards who signed into the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism just because they thought they were doing a good thing, and they were taken aback by what it is, and they are not implementing it really. But still, the culture they have introduced hovers over the place, and it has an effect of strangulation. But also, it has to be said that this kind of repression of the political, if you like, works a bit like Foucault's theorization of the repression hypothesis in sexuality. His argument was that during the Victorian era, the repression of sex and sexuality, etc., in fact, led to a proliferation of sexuality. And I think it's going to have this kind of effect, because even people who are not political are saying, why can't I be? Why can't I say something? And suddenly, sort of it leads to kind of this proliferation of the political. But there is no doubt that it is tragic. Just recently, I went to a conference in Tokyo, at University of Tokyo, and I was with an American and a British and a Japanese in this session. And the session was called Genocide in Gaza. And we were looking at each other, the British, the American, and me coming from Australia, and saying, This is just like seriously impossible to think in any of our universities that we would have simply a conference session called Genocide in Gaza. So that's terrible that we are increasingly having to find spaces outside the spaces of our Western universities, which are supposed to be the places of refuge, precisely. It's the same. I mean, I went also after this to Michigan. I genuinely felt, entering the United States, the last time I felt like this was when I entered Syria under Assad's dictatorship. That's not good, obviously.
It's almost like this reversal of the lens where for years you hear about, you know, Assad Syria, Khomeini's Iran, or this as these really repressive spaces, and in some cases they are, and how much that has, I guess in a Nietzschean sense, how much the Americans staring into that have brought all those paranoias and fears and taken them home and increased them in a large amount.
Yes, absolutely. And there is a sense where we think of it in terms of exceptionality, that no, we are really democratic, but this is really a difficult period. And so we're only not being sort of like, we're not protecting freedom of speech, we're not being democratic, but only because of this difficult issue. I don't know why it's difficult in some ways, but then let's say, okay, it's difficult. And you convince yourself that, okay, you're going to be anti-democratic for a month, 2 months, 3 months, and then, but then you find that actually it's gone away. And what you think you were, essentially, you're not. You are essentially what you are practicing at that very moment, i.e., you're not protecting freedom of speech. You're not democratic.
In Australia, it has this effect where a political class is completely detached from any public reality, any reality of the citizen. This all happens during an election time, and you'd hope that someone might take a stand, but we're seeing kind of a void.
Well, I mean, Australian culture, colonial culture, and racial culture has always worked tangentially, you know. It worked tangentially. What I mean, it just like touches you on the side, not frontally. Like, it's very hard to see. I mean, it's possible, but in the Australian tradition, you wouldn't have this in-your-face racism that you have now in the United States, for instance, towards Palestinians. You had it towards indigenous people in a very kind of like specific way, but it wouldn't be extending to everyone in the population. This is a kind of like you feel yourself, you're being strangulated, and you think, why? Who is strangulating me? But you're being strangulated just as effectively as you are being strangulated in the United States. But somehow the agent of the strangulation is floating around throughout the culture, so it's very hard to pinpoint.
It's more elusive here. I've always felt being an immigrant, it kind of feels like an invisible molasses slowly blanketing everyone and muting community connections and conversations that would otherwise go against this sort of culture.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of work by innuendo, there's work about potentially things. Look at Dutton's suggestion, and maybe he's not suggesting that people with dual citizenship even the mere fact of suggesting this, what is this? It is war against people with dual citizenship. It's creating a big gap in Australia between people who feel confidently at home and people who don't feel confidently at home. And yeah, I mean, it's racist through and through. And people still say, oh, controversial. No, it's not controversial. It's racist. I mean, like this history of referring to Pauline Hanson, I was just actually remembering it because she was in Tasmania launching her daughter's political career. Her daughter is going has been living in Tasmania and is going to run for One Nation in Tasmania. And the article had controversial politician, Pauline Hanson, says, give me a break. What's so bloody controversial about it? She's a bloody racist. That's what she is. There's nothing controversial about this.
It struck me what you said in another interview about this period, that it's a period of naked power, that
yes.
All the facades have sort of fallen off. And this is just kind of, there's a arrogance to it all.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. It's an arrogance, but it is at the same time the arrogance of the weak. Because as I was saying before, it is about this sense of power. Usually those who feel confident in their power, you know, like there's a word in Arabic, it's like wahra, which means your aura. There's people who have, like in traditional settings, like patriarchal power. It could be like a chief has an aura of power, and you respect that person just by the mere fact that they have appeared on the scene. And you say, whoa, you flabbergast me with your amazing sort of like aura. You shine power, etc. This kind of, I mean, we're talking about really weak people. None of these people have an aura of power. They have to use, I mean, it's like the classical thing, the sort of like you have the patriarchy of the person who is a respected patriarch and the petty patriarchy of the person who needs to engage in domestic violence to be respected. Sure, both of them are bad patriarchies, but there is a strong patriarchy of a patriarch who's respected, and there is a weak patriarchy of someone who has to rely on domestic violence to be in power. And what we have is really that second version. They're all, yeah, engaging in domestic violence, really. Not of the same type, but elements of it.
And just coming up to sort of the end, I just wanted to see if maybe you had any other reflections of the period, but maybe mostly to not end it all on a bitter note, what's some advice, I guess, from a career fighter like yourself for younger people coming into a solidarity movement to not lose hope and to stay active and do more things?
Well, you know, I mean, I think there are two things that I automatically think of. One, the importance of protecting yourself, because what we are facing is a serious attempt to harm us. And if you are political and if you are someone who has a conscience of being a humane person, people can hurt you. And so you have to protect yourself. The other thing is that you should strive not to be in a situation which is a terrible situation where we're all individualized. We don't have any sense of collectivity. It has been destroyed long ago. And that's the space where people like us who are engaging in talking start replacing actual organization and collective action by just radical sound bites, which are not an alternative to actual organization and collective resistance.
Thanks very much for your time, Ghassan Haj. I'll see you on Monday.
Look forward to seeing you too. Thanks. Bye.